jumped down off the edge of the platform and walked over to him, explaining that the camp layout was a little confusing, something which I, feeling lazy by this time of the evening, hadn't fully realised. Apparently there were three exits and entrances, with one of the clear-cut paths being a loop around past the privy, and then back onto the northbound trail. The tricky part was that it initially headed off southbound to hit the privy first, and then gently looped back to the northbound trail. It was easy to go the wrong way and not even realise. The hiker, whose name was Dan, had apparently fallen foul of this over 2 hours before. "I've been here already," he said miserably. "Damn hiker in here before told me that away was south. Getting dark under these here trees, and I didn't realise I'd done a goddamn loop back to the same damn place. I saw this shelter coming up, and I was just so happy that I'd made it. But it's the same one I was at 2 fucking hours ago." I couldn't look at the guy. I didn't want to add to his obvious embarrassment. Hatchet, in his matter-of-fact way, pointed out the correct southbound route, and, to my surprise, Dan just turned and walked towards it, disappearing into the gloom without a word. There was not another camp spot listed on my map for 10 more miles. Jesus. "Oh, that was you," I said, with a wry smile. "Sorry that happened. You camp okay?" He said yes, and asked where my friend was. "Good question," I replied, remembering that I was a bit worried about how long she'd taken to catch up. Dan and I kicked our heels at the shelter for a while. I went to filter water at the stream nearby and wandered back. Digging into my pack, I pulled out 2 Clif Bars and offered him one. We ate in silence, listening to the breeze through the pines and keeping out of the hot sun. It was about 40 minutes later that Kate arrived and filled her bottles at the stream. We agreed that she'd rest a little, and I'd go on ahead up the mile of elevation to the top of Whitecap. It wasn't an easy climb, but the trail was beautifully maintained. No mean feat when it was so deep in the woods. Steps had been cut into the mountainside, which made things slightly easier, but I still found myself leaning on my poles and gasping for breath, cursing my too heavy pack. Peeking through the thickly needled branches, I guessed that I was in for a big view at the top. I was learning that such is the way of Maine, and probably the rest of the trail ahead. The foreplay of mud, sweat, and claustrophobic tree cover gives way to an explosive mountaintop view at the summit when you emerge from the green gloom. I could feel the hot, wet chafe of pack straps where my vest had ridden up on my back. Pulling back the pale, juddery flesh on my love handles and exposing tender skin for the tag team of mosquitoes I'd been amassing since Katahdin. I knew I couldn't give these things the slightest bit of attention, or they'd utterly overwhelm me. So I just kept pushing up, tired legs taking missteps, and my clumsy feet skittering rocks off the ledge into the seething morass of wild, woody fingers below. You know when you're getting close to the top of a peak in Maine, because the soupy thick branches begin to thin out and more light gets in. You'd think that seeing skeletal branches and spindly brittle trunks would make me sad about nature. But no, I was just maniacally delighted that this meant the end of the climb and some big boulders to place my tired ass on at the top. And it was worth the effort, popping out of the tree cover like a grasping hand at the end of a tight sweater sleeve. I breathed a huge lungful of clear air and looked for miles in every direction. I could see nearly 200 miles of the Appalachian Trail from up here, stretching from Katahdin to the Bigelow Horns in the distance. Little did I know how much was to happen between now and those peaks, which looked so insignificant to my tired eyes. Settling myself on a rock, I opened my maw and fisted handful after handful of the sugar rainbow inside it. M&Ms, Skittles, trail mix and Clif Bars were thrown down, which made me regret only having 0.5 litre of water left to follow them with. Sitting still a while, my internal barometer moved from elation to calm, to cold, to annoyed and worried. I watched the dark clouds play grandmother's footsteps with me every time I looked down or turned to dig in my pack for a sweater, and the first fat drops of cold rain down my neck told me that I shouldn't have been so eager to push on and upwards without checking the weather for us. Once Kate had arrived, we didn't spend long at the summit. We were both tired, and the weather eclipsed what could have been an argument as thunder grew ever closer. I estimated it would take 45 minutes to get down, maybe more. It was definitely going to feel like more when being chased by a storm and fork lightning up on top of a bald. I was still learning how to estimate distance and speed over tricky ground, so at this stage my guesses were worth as much as my opinions on how to make baked Alaska, poor at best. So we just set off. As the rain started to belt down, Kate yelled at me over the thunder to go, go, go! She was right. The top of a mountain in a storm was not the place to be, and the sooner we got down, the sooner we could find better shelter. The flat dirt of the top quickly moved into a slimy stream downwards, keeping me heel skidding and holding on to spindly trunks to stay upright. Next, rough-hewn, deep stone steps covered in pine needles and rotted mulch. Perfect for toppling down with a heavy pack in the rain and poor visibility, to be found weeks later lodged headfirst between some boulders and undergrowth at the bottom of a ravine, nibbled by woodland foragers. Fuck. Laser focus and a seat-of-the-pants madness propelled me to the bottom after about an hour, with skinned legs and blisters pretty much everywhere that something had touched my sad, wet body. It was dusky as the trail levelled out at the bottom, and what felt like a perpetual descent into the bowels of a beast became less panicked and much safer. I readjusted my straps, flumped my pack up a bit with some pride, and had a word with myself, accepting that we probably wouldn't be going the further 4 miles that I'd planned to get to the next shelter. Where would we sleep? I pulled up the map and looked. Just around the bend, by about 5 minutes, was a flat camp space, affording me a little bit of relief. It felt like it was my responsibility to check out and make it nice for when Kate arrived, so I took the risk of going a bit further without her. I didn't expect to meet anyone this late between shelters, so I couldn't quite make out what I was seeing set back from the trail in the thickets of deeper forest. Twinkling lights and soft voices, not the noise from a hiker or two settling in for a sleep. A group. How? It faded out as I rounded a corner, only to appear again from what seemed like a different space back inside the woods. I was reminded of wood elves firing up their feasts deep inside Mirkwood in Tolkien's Hobbit, only to lure unsuspecting walkers deeper into the maze. Fuck that. I was going nowhere near it. Jesus Christ, why couldn't I just have an easy day? Now I had to deal with elves? Maybe I was hallucinating in exhaustion. Seeing the sign for the old campground loom out of the gloom ahead, I sped up, only to howl at the closed for trail maintenance sign plastered over the top. So this was it, a trail crew. Volunteers come out to the trail all summer and spend weeks living deep in the backwoods to repair and renovate steps and paths for hikers. Amazing. But today, their benevolent camp enclosure was possibly going to push me over the edge. Hello? Hello? Gently pushing through the branches towards the light, I figured that a bit of British-accented politeness might get me what I desperately needed. Permission to stop and camp for the night. Excuse me? I edged through into a clearing, and the circle of hardy mountain-ready folk standing around a warm fire all turned to look at me, a bedraggled goon who had most of the gear and definitely no idea. It was, remember, still only day 5 of my hiking career. After a little negotiation and some incredible kindness from the crew, I backed out of the clearing and onto the trail. Picking a little clear spot for us on the side of the path, I set about putting up my tent. The campground space itself was filled with the maintenance folks and their gear, but they had no objection to us setting up trailside. This put me right in the pathway of the murderers and rapists I generally thought were always hot on my heels, but I didn't have many options and wouldn't be alone, so it was all fine by me. Deciding that my priority would be offering to cook for Kate when she arrived, I sought out a water source to replenish my bottles. This was, of course, 300 metres down a slippery, off-trail blue blaze, where I'm sure bears were sizing me up, but I grabbed 2 litres of ice cream cold water from the spring and dragged myself back to the top, fully expecting to see a cross Kate waiting by my tent. But no. And so it was that I found myself heading back up those sharp-cut white cap steps into the darkness, skinning my knees to find my friend. Bone-tired, we stood on the path after I'd located her stepping down what she termed as Stonehenge fuckers towards the bottom of the mountain. She set up her shelter, and some unpacking, mud-scrambling and stove-cooking later, we both sat in our tent openings, looking at each other with a little more kindness and trying to find the good in our day of achievements, which felt a little more like a day of survival. Despite being only around 8 p.m, it was fully dark, and there wasn't much left to do except crawl into bed and sleep. In the stillness of thinking about asking our bones to move, we heard footsteps. Not the steady steps of someone heading down to the spring from the maintenance team, and not the weary slop of someone exhausted from a day of hiking. It was a bouncy stride, one full of mischief and coiled energy. Then a figure all but skidded sideways into our little camp, someone arriving with a palpable energy field around them, who stopped dead centre between the tents. "Yo!" it said, 6 feet 4 tall and built like a brick shithouse. "Yo, girls! What's happening?" With a backpack smaller than Fivel's, the mouse in an American tail, our new trail friend stood grinning at us. In the dim light of our head torches, we appraised him. Long brown hair, a big bushy beard, and a charismatic grin that seemed to lift the mood of our tiny camp a number of notches without doing anything particular to earn it. Kate raised her eyes from the dirt and old fire pit she'd been staring at. She knows a dickhead, like a fisherman knows the tides, and I could see from her face she wasn't sure. "Woohoof!" he said. "Damn, that was a good day." "How far have you come?" I wondered whether our valiant attempts to scale mountains and do distance today had been anywhere near comparable. "Oh, just since Antlers." What? 25 miles? What was this guy about? I was already feeling that familiar rise of interest in someone so unusual. He was disarmingly friendly, and, more than anything, had an air of capability that in this moment I was desperate for. Like someone had slotted a chair underneath me as I was about to collapse from standing and encouraged me to sit for a moment, to rest with the support of something stronger. I became aware that I had a dumb grin plastered across my face looking at him, and snuck a glance to my right at Kate. She had exactly the same look, a half smirk and sparkly eyes. Good. This was good. In the dusk, I asked him a couple of other brief questions about how long he'd been on trail. He was still standing and we were sitting, still emerging with our heads and legs like turtles from our tent shells. I felt briefly desperate. I didn't want this ball of energy to leave and burn through the dark trailside camp we'd made. He dumped his bag into the grass on the side of the path and gave the old fire between us a little nudge with his foot. "Better get some sticks for this, hey?" he grinned, and I knew he was staying. I watched in awe as he gathered some wood, started a little fire, and then sat in the dirt, not at all worried about getting muddy. Peeling off his damp socks, he lay them on stones around the fire and settled back down with dirty, slightly steaming feet and pulled his purple hood over his long, dark hair. "What's your name?" I asked, mesmerised. "Buckshot." "Ha ha!" he had said it. "Buckshot!" And the accent tickled me. "You look more like a Viking with your big beard and being 6'4", I said, laughing. "Well, that sounds good to me," he said. grinning right back. He tipped out his tiny bag. Packets of tuna, Ziplocs with a range of mystery ingredients and some snack bars tumbled out, alongside a few other essentials and some fluttery bits of fabric. "Is that it?" I asked incredulously. "Where's the rest of your stuff?" "Ha! That's it. I don't need any more. Well, actually, to be honest, I might have fucked up on the food. But that's okay. I'll just go without and crush those miles to get out of here in a few days anyway." I thought about my pack and I cringed with embarrassment. Ugh! I had about 17 times more food than him, and I only needed it until halfway through, when we'd get our food pickup off the dirt road from Old Man. "I've got some you can have," Kate and I chorused. We glanced at each other and grinned, then waterfalled all manner of Haribo soup packets, oatmeal and granola bars on this man we hadn't known for more than 30 minutes. He willingly took what we offered and set about flapping his little pieces of fabric out and magicking them into his shelter, almost right on the path. I looked at it, weighing up exposing myself as a novice and a tit by asking him about his setup, or just nodding towards it and making that face that men use when they look inside each other's car bonnets, like, yeah, see what you've done there, and all that. Considering my bulging pack, legs full of scratches, and the fact he knew we'd done a huge 12 miles that day, I figured I wasn't fooling anyone. How do you sleep under, what happens when it, what's that? I gestured at the sheet pegged 2 feet off the ground, with his shortened hiking pole supporting each end. "That's my tarp," he grinned, wiggling underneath it, feet first, and then expertly pulling in all his belongings as his arms darted out at different angles to gather them all. "See," he said, muffled by a quilt and all his things now in the tarp burrow. "Super light, keeps me dry and easy to put up anywhere." I had lots of thoughts about this. What about when it rained? Didn't the water just run over his body because the tarp sides didn't touch the ground? And the wind? Didn't that just blow right through? And bears? Bears could reach in for snacks! On that, I realised Kate and I hadn't gone about our nightly ritual. "Bear bags, Kate," I said. Not a question, a statement. Bear bags were a Kate job. One of the things she'd worked hard on before coming with me was how to tie the knots and hang the bags. I didn't do this. I am afraid of knots. I can't understand the many different planes that the rope has to go through on all those stupid diagrams, and it just makes me mad that I don't get it, so I had decided to not think about it. Luckily, she had. She dragged herself up and moved towards her food sack, and then to mine, which I'd snapped at the top and slung out of my tent. I heard a snort of laughter from under the tarp. "Bear bags! Fucking bear bags!" Our new friend clearly found this very amusing. "You don't need those!" He poked his head out of the tarp until his whole head, aside from his big beard, was clear. "Ain't no bears around here that are brave enough to come get food from us. Maine hunts bears. They ain't stupid. You don't need to hang your food. Sling it in your tent." Our new friend had a point. When settlers first arrived in Maine, the black bear population was so large that they caused myriad problems for people. In an effort to nip this in the bud, the state put its first bounty on bears in 1770. Since then, bear hunting has been a popular pastime in Maine and other states, with cash rewards for hunting bears only disappearing in 1957. Although well regulated, popular, and in keeping with our friend's laissez-faire attitude to bear bags, hunting of bears has actually decreased in the state, meaning that the number of bears has doubled in the last 35 years because hunters aren't shooting enough of them. I love this statistic for the bears, but not for being careless with my food. As the saying goes, I didn't know the saying yet, but I would soon enough, a fed bear is a dead bear. So I was keen to get that food into those trees. "Well, you know, we just want to," I said to his tarp, as I gestured at Kate that we should go hang the bags. She nodded, and we scoped the clearing around the trail where we had pitched up. Nothing obvious, You've got to find a branch at the right height. That's the right distance from the trunk so a bear can't shimmy up and lean out to grab it. Smart little ursines. We eventually found something that could work and tried to get it up. Kate was the knot-tying logistical one, and I was the jumping-throwing one. After a couple of tries, it was clear that I was too short to get it over, and we looked like a pair of idiots. As I crouched to take another leap, I realised that all 6'4" of our friendly hiker was standing right behind us, grinning from ear to ear. "You want some help?" he asked. I nodded, furious that I had to let a man step in to help, but so exhausted that I didn't really care anymore. He put out a giant paw, took the bag from me, and extended his long arm up, casually hooking the bags onto a long bough. "That'll do it," he said, and loped back. Kate had already gone to pass out in her sleeping bag, so I padded back to my tent in time to see Buckshot's head and shoulders disappear under his tarp. Done for the day. It was silent as I walked by, but as I unzipped my tent fly, I heard, "Good night, Appalachian Gale. Glad to have met you." "You too, Buckshot." And I slept more soundly that night than before. The next morning, I stirred awake to the sounds of low voices close to my tent. "So, I'll lead this morning's stretch, and you guys think of a stretch of your own, and somewhere you've always wanted to visit in the world. Then, when I've done mine, I'll point to a person, and you can show us your stretch and talk to us as we copy. Everyone good?" I wriggled outside in all my layers. "Morning!" I honked with a grin at the group of 9 or so people in a circle across the path. "How are you all? What's going on?" "Stretching circle," said a familiar face from the trail crew the night before. "Cool," I thought for a beat. "Can I join in?" They looked at each other and one or two shrugged. "Sure, okay." So I gave Kate's tent a little nudge with my foot as I heaved myself up and went to join them. She emerged, and with her happy, sullen face, I knew she was begrudgingly pleased to be involved. We stretched, bent, hopped, and steadied ourselves for the next 10 minutes, listening to people show all manner of body movements, of which some were more like someone had turned the music off in musical statues than stretching, and listened to stories and dreams about visits to Italy, Japan, and Canada. Buckshot didn't stir. After the crew had hoiked their tools and bags up and dispersed into the woods, we set about packing up. Kate went to get water from the spring, no bears, and I chatted with a recently emerged Buckshot. I finished squashing a million things down into my pack and fisting the tendrils back inside, a constant battle for someone who bought an ultralight pack and then stuffed it with enough shit to sink a ship. "I'm going to head down a couple blue blazes today to see the waterfalls at Gulf Haggis. Want to come?" Looking up at him through my 4-day-old hare nest, I thought this sounded like a fantastic idea. Adventure! He was so confident, and I was so buoyed up by his enthusiasm after my days of slog that this was like a little electric jolt. Kate, though. I couldn't leave Kate. "Do it, mate! Do it!" She ambled up behind us, arms filled with slithery slick water pouches that wouldn't stay put. "Fuck me, it'll be great. You can go the longer way on the blue blaze, and I'll follow the AT. By the time you get back on the path, then I'll have made it to about the same place as you, but at my own pace." "Perfect." She looked hard at me. She meant it. "I don't know. I feel bad. What if you get lost or something happens? You don't have the GPS and the phones don't work. What if we miss meeting? How will we ever find each other again?" "Jesus," Buckshot grinned. "Just relax. It's one path. Choose a shelter. We'll go there, so will she, and no one leaves until the others get there. It's easy." I wasn't sure. A blue blaze is a spur trail leading off the main trail and can lead to all kinds of things. A shelter, view, campground, or some beautiful natural feature like waterfalls. Gulf Haggis, I was told by Buckshot, was well worth the visit. A long, tumbling gorge with rushing snowmelt waters foisting themselves through narrow gaps and long drops. Damn it, it did sound exciting, and I was here to experience things. Okay, I'm in. You promise you'll be okay, Kate? Yes, yes. Fuck off and go. See you later. She grinned and gestured down the path where Buckshot was already steadily wandering ahead. Fuck! Okay, fuck it. Right, see you soon. Don't go off the path. Keep safe. I'll see you at the shelter. And I was gone, hop-skipping after the long-legged, sturdy mystery who had vanished between the trees. Hey, Appalachian Gale, he drawled as he sensed me coming up behind him. So we walked, a few miles still following the white blazes before we turned off into the unknown. I balanced on rocks over swollen streams as he moved his huge frame nimbly between trees and under overhangs. I asked him what he did, a question I was later to become aware was not okay with many hikers on trail, but at this stage I was still happily blundering into trail faux pas and having the time of my life. He had been a cook, or a chef, as he first presented it, later to be a cook at the college canteen, and was now a full-time hiker. To my amazement, this was his third stint on the Appalachian Trail and his first time sobo. He'd hiked northbound a few years before, his first long hike, then almost completed another nobo before deciding to hike the Continental Divide Trail last year, a much longer and more remote trail stretching 3,100 miles from where the Mexican border meets the USA in New Mexico to the northern border of Alberta, Canada. It was a distant dream of mine to hike it, and I was under no illusion that it was easy. Not so much a simple trail, but a journey through an immensely diverse landscape. It is described by the Continental Divide Trail org as a living museum of the American West. I enjoyed hearing him describe the water carries and animals, but then he tired of talking and peppered me with questions instead. The flurry of our excited chat petered out into companionable silence. The only thing slowing my roll was my unwieldy pack catching on branches and my feet slipping sideways from slick rocks into the mud. Then a blue blaze. It was time to turn off trail. We had been walking a little while. I wasn't paying much attention to the trail because we were deep in conversation again. I was in awe of his ease and comfort in the surroundings. We discussed childhood, the UK, language, and then the conversation turned to Netflix, TV shows, and podcasts. It was a little while into our chattering about My Favourite Murder and other unsolved abduction shows that I began to feel a tickling unease. And how do these women just not even second guess when the dude is clearly psycho? He said from ahead of me, pushing back branches as he shouldered through. A cold wash spread from my lower back around to my tummy, making my guts clench and my jaw tighten before I had any idea why. I started sweating, began to feel nauseous. What was it? Buckshot was four paces ahead, his huge legs stepping over blowdowns and pulling greenery out of the pathway. This pathway where no one else had been for a very long time. My hindbrain grabbed me and shook me into understanding. Danger. Danger. I swooned at my idiocy. What was I doing? How could I have prepared for 10 months for this trip and considered every conceivable aspect of it, and then found myself following a huge man I didn't know for over a mile down track in the deepest forest imaginable to a waterfall with no signal, service, or way of contacting my friend? Is this how it happens? So blithely and easily we are lured into vulnerability, and then it's too late. I've lived an adult lifetime of trying to balance my deep fear and lived experience with the usual gut warnings that we all get and should listen to. Listen to your gut, ladies, is the usual mantra. If something feels wrong, then it usually is. Well, is it? What if you have already, like me, been assaulted in your life? then perhaps on some level you're insecure about your judgment and ability to make decisions, because once you made some and they were deeply wrong. So anyway, I've been hearing there are some great new podcasts about true crime. Apparently there's one where these people talk about folks who go missing and they're trying to figure out where they went. Kind of cool, but weird too, you know? He looked back at me with what I saw as a sinister smile. This is where we were at. I flipped back into focus. Fuck, I've come out here with a murderer. One who's not even trying to be secretive. I watched him ahead, clearing the way for me, not looking backwards. I jumped as a returning branch flipped itself out of the bush next to me and brushed my shoulder. I knew I was going to die. Only choice? Keep him talking. So, Buckshot. Well, do you have friends out here? Didn't you say you were hiking with some other people too? A guy? Oh, yeah. Lazy Bean and Dozer. She's kind of new to hiking. He was waiting on her. They were taking ages, so I just carried on walking. They're behind. I'll see him. I wondered then if the friends were a lie to make him seem more approachable. My mind was spiraling. What if there was someone waiting for us ahead, in a place already laid out, where they come to take women? We were deep in the woods. I hadn't seen or heard a soul for a long time, and it was clear people didn't take this path. I could feel my body moving forwards whilst at the same time not wanting to move forwards. Don't give myself away. I was wet with sweat, my skin pulsing with 1,000 heartbeats. I wanted to make a joke, to make light of my fear. I wanted to not feel so caught in the gossamer strings of deliberation, between feeling like I was afraid and wanting to run, between the risk of embarrassing myself into utter mortification and the dreadful instilled coding that was telling me not to be rude or disrespectful. I didn't want to make a fuss. I was too afraid I'd be mocked, or even worse, actually incite the violence I feared would come. Stupid, stupid, stupid! I remained mute as I walked towards what I was convinced was now my fate. My death would be my reward for trying to achieve something so far outside of my comfort zone. Of course this was it for me, my final destination moment, always here, waiting for me. With slippery hands riven with red mosquito bites, I tried to unzip my bum bag without changing the cadence of my walk, lest he hear and turn around. Wedging one finger and my thumb through the tiny gap, I managed to winkle out my knife, a gift from my father before I left home. I flicked the blade open and held it behind my back, all the while still walking deeper into the woods with this man. Mortified, terrified and choked by my blinding fear. But then I stopped. My grey matter was tallying up options and suddenly triaged them down to a course of action. I said clearly, Buckshot. He stopped. Yeah? My voice was trembling. I need to ask. I mean, I've been thinking. I'm just going to ask. Look, if you were going to do it, it wouldn't matter anyway that I've asked, but I just can't bear it. So direct. Now cut to the chase. What the heck's the matter? His bushy beard corralled a concerned line where previously a big smile had sat. Sure, ask anything you want. He leaned slightly forwards towards me on his stick and obviously noted my pasty skin and wide eyes. Gail! What is it? Such a long pause. Such suffocating silence, except the tick of greenery unfolding behind us to cover the scene. Complicit, nature more his friend than mine. I took a deep breath. Are you going to kill me? He paused and squinted at me for a brief moment, serious and sinister, before throwing his head backwards and laughing so loudly it made me jump out of my skin. Such embarrassment. It consumed me in an instantaneous roar, a Roman candle of shame. Of course my gut was wrong. My compass broke when I was 18. It's just set up for hypervigilance now. Well, I just need to know. I can't bear it. I've been thinking about it for the last 10 minutes, and we've been talking all about murder podcasts, and I'm miles away and I don't know the way back, and... He was grinning and proffered a hand in my direction, patting the air and still lazed loosely on his stick, unfazed. It's okay, Appalachian Gale, he said, drawling out my name like a cowboy. Listen, I'm not gonna kill you. I just really want to see these waterfalls. Damn, hikers always miss the blue blazes because they don't want to walk an extra mile or two. Well, fuck it. I decided this time I was going to see the good stuff and thought you might want to see it too. So, I am not going to kill you, and I am sorry you've been... Wait, what are you holding?
Nothing. Fuck!
What have you got there? Honestly, nothing. Just fixing my straps. I managed to stuff the knife into a side pocket on my pack. His stillness, surety, and comfort with being so off-trail, so deep in the woods with no fear of being alone out here, were amazing and so soothing to me. I so desperately wanted to be like him and not feel so scared. I wanted to go on with him, but I knew I couldn't. I was still so afraid. This stirring in me, the memory of before the fear. I knew going through the process to get my courage would bring physical pain with it too. My mental trauma always loved some physical company. Later, I'd look back, tell this story, and laugh. But not now. I felt sick, ashamed, embarrassed, and angry at my gut for giving me warnings too late in my life, and me being wrong about them, ruining yet more chances at fun. I said, looking at my feet. What you want to do? He asked, looking busy swigging water from his pack and giving me space. I was too embarrassed to speak. A deep red. I'm going to go.
Okay.
Pause. I don't know how to get back and not double hike all those miles, though. I wanted to bark hysterically at the lunacy of asking my imagined captor for directions home. Okay, no problem. And he explained the route kindly and patiently. Then, it's okay, you know, G. No judgment. Here in the woods, it all comes out. No hiding from nature. She knows. I nodded, turned, and walked, looking over my shoulder until he'd gone, and then running, racing through the path and crying, hot tears of shame, memories of hands on me in the dark, fear I couldn't contain. The hounds of hell were coming for me, and I ran for what seemed like forever in the lonely forest, looking for my friend. It wouldn't be the last time. Chapter 6. The Real Beginning. After I'd caught up with Kate and gathered my tears back in, we ploughed on, both slowing as the elevation increased. Buckshot passed me later in the afternoon on strong legs and, with a cheery smile, hollered hello, checking in on me as I cringed in embarrassment. It was as though he'd just forgotten, which suited me just fine. The days blended together as we became dirtier and more exhausted. I became more short-tempered with Kate the further we fell behind. Finally, we met Lazy Bean and Dozer, wearing tunics and reading paperbacks by the fire on the night our paths crossed, ripping pages red and tossing them into the flames to keep their pack weight as low as possible. It seemed an interminable amount of time to still be in the 100-mile wilderness. But we had only a day or two to go. We were filthy, a level of grime I never felt possible. Falling in streams, down mud banks, and being rained on for over 40 hours at one point meant that every item we had was damp, cold, or putrid, and our food was nearly gone. There was only the shit stuff left. Oh, what a bad decision, leaving the grossest food until last when we felt the worst. We had no choices, though. We had to keep going, imagine the beer at the end, and mentally remove ourselves from the discomfort. Most other hikers were suffering, so we took solace in each other. Some trail friends passed us fast and went on in a final burst of energy to get to the end of the stretch. Others caught up and joined us, staying close. Our legs took us down from mountaintops into bogs and swamps where whatever was left of our skin was feasted upon by the bugs. Tiredness made us less alert, brought home to me by a foolish misstep on a slimy rock, which made me skid forwards towards a steep edge. In an effort to not topple over, I pulled my body back into a swerve and a few rapid steps in the other direction. Down trail again, teetering over the edge of another slimy slick descent and not finding balance in time, momentum pushing me off the little precipice I had tried to stabilise on. Any split-second relief I felt from avoiding a more fateful fall disappeared as I landed on the side of the trail over the sharp spikes of some lower tree branches. I could feel one of them had ripped through my top, and I gasped at the sharp sting of slightly broken skin between my lower ribs. In that brief moment of slowed time, I realised that my heavy pack hadn't quite yet caught up with me. Mere microseconds later, it arrived, slamming into my back and wedging the sharp stick through the scratch it had made and deeper in between my ribs. Such pain! I lay unmoving for a few more moments, gathering my wits. Then I gently and slowly extricated my arms from my pack straps and unbuckled the belt. As the pack rolled and fell into the mud beside me, I braced my hand on the floor and pushed off the stick I was impaled on, gasping at the pain and looking gingerly down for damage. A rip through my top, a precise rip through my double-layered sports bra, and a genuine dark bloody hole in my side where the stick had pushed in. Nothing too bad, just a little painful to move, but I was aware of how close I had come to a more significant injury. It was clear that I really needed the rest and respite that was only days away. And then, the end was tantalisingly within sight. We had aimed to emerge from the forest late that final evening, but it became clear that it just wasn't possible. We were slowing and frustrated that we had to spend another night in the woods a mere 2 hours from the exit point, but it was what it was. The next morning, our shelter friends had organised a shuttle with Shaws, the legendary hostel at this side of the 100 Mile, for 6:30 a.m. at the trailhead, and asked us if we'd like in. Shaws sits in the town of Monson, the first town that any southbound hiker comes to after days, 10 for Kate and me, of privation, filth and exhaustion. For many hikers, the 100 Mile wilderness is truly like nothing they've ever experienced and puts the body through some semblance of shock and awe. The idea of a shower, warm bed and home-cooked food becomes a fixation the closer to town you hike. Shaws looms large in the imagination. In the late 70s, the Shaws started welcoming in hungry, tired hikers and cooking up huge breakfasts to feed them. Since then, the hostel has retained their name but moved through different ownerships, still keeping the traditions of excellent breakfasts and a warm welcome alive, or so we had been repeatedly told. Now owned by poet and hippie chick, through hikers themselves, it was raved about more than ever. I was so thoroughly ready to wash and eat that I didn't have much patience for a slow 4:30 a.m. start, foot-dragging hiking and the clear likelihood of missing the shuttle. But then we were out, emerging into the light to a hardtop road and civilization. Swept up by the shuttle, we were handed a welcome beer at 6:30 a.m, a classic Shaws tradition, whatever time you arrive. No sleep for us. Showering off 10 days of grime was a biblical experience, and the hot water baptism brought new vigour. I stood in a dreamlike state in the wooden hall next to the bathroom door I had chosen, slathered in dirt and high on hunger and exhaustion. It was 7:30 a.m. and I would have been swaying from my one beer if a hiker I'd come to know as Rock Naps hadn't swiped it to drink the moment I put it down to find clean loner clothes. "Oh, my bad," he exclaimed. "Shit, dude, I'll get you another later." Well, anyone who wanted a beer at 7:30 in the morning needed it more than me, and he was clearly a nice guy. The bathroom door opened and I walked into a cloud of hot steam. There was nothing clinical about this hostel. Each of the many bathrooms was a warm family space with an abundance of warm towels, toiletries to choose from, and the essentials that we hikers didn't have. Nail clippers, scrubbing brushes, and washcloths. In the stingingly hot water, I stood watching rivers of the darkest brown stream down my bruised and battered legs into the tub. I had never been so grateful. Over a never-ending breakfast with a pancake avalanche to eat, we met and chatted to our first northbound hikers, the friendly and helpful resident daddy and his crew, hikers who had travelled over 2,000 miles, battle-weary and lean, breaking bread with fresh, plump new hikers 100 miles in, eager to glean info. It was hard for them to know what to say to us. We were too green to hear how hard it would become, and too far in to be fobbed off with pleasantries. But we shared tales, and they gave much great, kind advice before we left the table. After breakfast, full and finding my bearings, I called home to talk to my parents. It had only been 2 weeks since we'd done more than send brief messages through my GPS tracker to assure them of my safety and for them to assure me of theirs, but it seemed already that there was a gulf between what they knew I was doing on paper and how I could explain the reality of it to them. I just didn't have a way to accurately explain the privation, pain, and joy of the wilderness, but they were happy to listen to my attempts and be excited by my telling of it. After leaving them with assurances that I'd make contact again when I could, I enjoyed spending the rest of the day navigating laundry, beers, and sunshine on the lawn. The next morning, I peeled the covers off my face in the old wooden bedroom and contemplated the incessant thumping of my head. I make poor decisions after drinking, even after only a couple of beers, so I ran through the tally of the events of the night before to figure out where I was at. Okay, not too bad. Kissing, no more. Lots of kissing and maybe some pressing of bodies together. But I was extremely glad I didn't give in to the impulse to take it further. Buckshot had been keen, but I'd stood firm and scurried to my room when it got too steamy and replied to his text from up there whilst he stood in the kitchen of the main house texting to assure me that no one was awake if I wanted to come back over. When I said no, I also explained that one-night stands were not my thing. I mean, I'd had them, but I knew how awful they made me feel. And with Kate about to leave and a new adventure in the woods about to begin alone, I didn't need the emotional or mental self-flagellation of getting humped and dumped by a hiker as I set out alone. Also, perhaps he and his crew might be great trail buddies for a while, and I didn't want to spoil it. Though there was no chance I'd be able to keep up with them. Two guys who'd already hiked the AT and the CDT, a girlfriend who had just completed a 100-plus-mile hike with them as a warm-up. Unlikely. I didn't really have a clue what I was doing, and it was only now becoming clear in reality that Kate was going, and I was just going to keep walking by myself. I felt the desperate schoolgirl yearning to be included, to not be left behind, but I squashed it with a reminder that I was a grown-ass woman and I didn't need to be included by anyone, that it would all work out. I grabbed for my phone on the nightstand, finally now working on Wi-Fi. Time? 8:30. Fuck. Up and dressed in moments, I decided not to waste my precious prescribed painkillers on something as self-inflicted as a hangover, so I necked a couple of ibuprofen and staggered down the stairs. I didn't want to miss breakfast, or chatting to folks to see what people's plans were, and another breakfast at Shaw's was not to be missed. I was a little bit late into the main dining area and felt immediately panicked. People were coming out, chatting in groups and putting stuff in packs. Kate was there, milling around and organising her things. "Hey, mate, how long until you go?" I asked. I suddenly didn't want her to go at all. I needed the yin to my yang. Her friendship and stoic logic felt so necessary. "About an hour," she said. "Are you going to be okay, Muller? Feels super strange to leave you." She looked at me closely. "I'm so excited to see my babies, though. I'm really going to miss you. I can't quite believe you're actually going." I also felt really bad that I'd been so short with her in the days towards the end of the 100 mile. I'm not sure whether this is indicative of who I really am under that much exhaustion and privation, or if it was just a reflection of the moods we had both been in. I left Kate to figure out her final packing and taxi order. She had a long and multi-part journey back to get out of the USA. As I wandered around the side of the large white clapboard hostel to the back garden, I saw Buckshot, Lazy Bean and Dozer standing with Rock Naps and some others, smoking pipes and chatting, the heavy and delicious smell of weed hanging in the clouds. Rock Naps was smoking something called dabs, which I'd never seen before. He had a little tray like a paint palette, with 6 or so different types of high-purity cannabis resin. These he heated and inhaled on a regular basis. He was so chatty and merry, I couldn't quite understand how he was stoned, because it didn't at all equate with the stoned I'd seen at home when I was younger, or even nowadays. I guess that might be the difference between legal marijuana and illegal. Maybe you get better stuff when it's more regulated and fewer people indoors just watching cartoons all day. At least, that's what it seemed like out here. "Hey, Appalachian Gale! All packed up?" Buckshot said and grinned at me as he took a hit off his pipe. The others were putting final snacks into the side of their packs, but not looking as though any departure was imminent, lolling on the side of the house.
Kind of," I said. "Pretty much done."
I was thinking about my pack explosion in the bedroom and that I needed to collect laundry and that I had a bunch of crap I needed to give Kate to take back home with her.
"Fuck it! Shouldn't take me long."
I tried my best to sound nonchalant as I asked, "What are you guys doing? Staying around today?" Although I could clearly see they probably weren't. They'd had 2 days off now, resting and chilling. It was me who wasn't rested. What with 10 days in the deep woods, utter shock and exhaustion, and then arriving here at dawn the previous day to drink and whoop it up all day in celebration. I definitely needed a break, some vegetables, and a good sleep with no booze. I didn't think I was going to get it.
"Nah, we're heading out in an hour or two. And Kit's probably going to come too, and Rock Naps maybe."
He looked over the grass at where Rock Naps had crawled into the tent he'd pitched on the lawn the night before, feet poking out the end.
"Not sure about him, though."
Buckshot looked down at me again from his height and stature. Not just his pure size, he also inhabited a mile-wide confidence and assuredness, like he knew anything and everything that could happen next out here, and none of it would faze him in the slightest. The corners of his big mouth twitched up as he let the pause and gaze linger. "And you?"
"What?" I said with a throwaway cackle. "Ha ha, you must be kidding. Me? I can't keep up with you guys. I haven't even had a zero yet. You're all experienced and shit, I'm just learning this stuff."
Lazy Bean turned and smiled at me, and then at Buckshot.
"Shit, Buck, she's right," he drawled. "We're going to pull out of here around 11 a.m. and drop a 30-miler, I reckon."
He squinted at me, his face kind and joking. "Reckon you can do 30 miles before dark tonight, G?
Come on, I know you can."
I had no fucking idea what was going on. Were they joking entirely? Were they looking for me to start with them, then laugh at me as they went on and left me 10 miles in, scratched, dirty and bawling? Or did they honestly mistake me as someone who could keep up? I didn't quite know what to say, so laughed and nodded, "Sure, sure, I could keep up, you know." And I told them I was going to pack up. I wandered across the yard casually,
opened the back door to the steps up to my room and, as soon as the door closed behind me, rocketed up to get my stuff together in a wild, panicked flurry. As I packed, my brain carried on a solid narrative. You know, really helpful like brains are. I despaired that I felt such urgency to be part of a group. Surely the whole reason to try this incredible feat was to complete it without help, without support. I had to show that my body could thrive, that all the times I'd had to stop and give up in the past and needed help were behind me. I was a new person. I was brave now. I didn't need help or support. I was well. I didn't need help. But my God, the urge to be accepted into a circle, to not do it alone, was overwhelming, physically as well as mentally, shown by the speed of the very hands I was looking at as they shoved everything and anything haphazardly into my bag so I could get outside in time. I stopped to take a breath. More haste, less speed. Just be present in myself, and what will be, will be. I packed slowly and carefully, and then took my things down to the yard, not knowing who or what would be there, but knowing for sure that saying goodbye to Kate was my first priority. We hugged, and I slipped her my GoPro and Kindle, some chargers, and various bits of memorabilia I'd picked up in the last 2 weeks. All to take home, and the first of many shakedowns. Thanking her, I explained with swimming eyes what she had meant to me in coming to see me through the beginning of this journey. Only now, in the losing of her, realizing how much I had needed her. Kate isn't one for emotion, but she hugged me hard in return. Sorry, I said again, for losing my temper and being short sometimes. I didn't really know myself. It's okay. She raised a tired smile, no more than I deserved in the bigger picture. Always with the logic. She hoisted her bag and we walked to the waiting taxi, with her waving at Buckshot and his friends and giving Rocknaps a hard hug before she opened the door and moved to sling herself in after her pack. I hustled up to the window. Please stay, I blurted out, wiping unexpected tears with the back of my hand so she didn't see. She stopped in reverse direction, lifting herself back out. Pop it, she said, looking hard at me. You don't need me to stay. You're going to be all right. This is it, your journey. It starts now. My face crumpled, and she put her hand on my shoulder. Muller, you can do this. I love you. Love you too, I said, and pulled her, the hug-hater, into another big squeeze. I closed the door on her and leaned to wave through the glass. The taxi, in no way as emotionally connected to the moment as I was, reversed neatly away from me out of the driveway, paused, and then pulled forwards again, Kate's little face pressed to the glass and her fingertips waving over the headrest until she was gone from sight. I felt so naked, caught in this moment, blankets whipped off. The thought through my body, like a flush of cold water, that I'd made the wrong choice and wasn't strong enough for this, that I was a fraud, too old, too fat, my body too weak and unreliable. I'd tap out with the pain again. It's always been that way. Ah, my pain. It always turned up in the end when I had something fun planned, some adventure or event to look forward to. Sometimes it let me really get close and my excitement to truly build, but it would always appear, slipping into the scene with a dark nod to tell me that my time was up. It wasn't unassuming and small either. It eventually came to inhabit the entire right side of my body, snaking through my pelvis and up my spine, through the back of my ribs and down my arm. Pain that was amorphous, that had no sides or shape or point to where it hurts clarity. It was a pain that felt like a swelling, that one side of my body had died and was bloating whilst attached to me, but also electrified and awake. Not phantom pain, zombie pain. It changed everything about me in my life, even having a say in how I dressed, like a controlling partner. I wore no tight trousers, no stylish clothes with interesting cuts. I wore frumpy elasticated waist trousers to work rather than tailored styles because I couldn't stand any fabric or pressure on my skin. I dragged my right foot but hid it by pausing and leaning on walls at school. I had to lift my right leg in and out of the car and would inwardly scream when jostled at a supermarket. I would drive into town to buy clothes or to Sainsbury's to buy food and then would drive around the car park and out again when I saw how many people there were, as I didn't know how I could navigate my way through without the agony that came with moving the trolley left and right to avoid people. I cancelled drinks with friends, dodged birthday parties, bailed on weekends away, swerved happy social gatherings and sports events, and even let my rowing team down without a proper explanation. How do you convincingly explain what's wrong with you when you don't know, the doctors don't know, and no one, not even you, can see it? It's easier to shrink away, hide, and just save your spoons of effort for working and bringing in money to pay the bills and the modicum of dignity this provides. And now I was here, my body so far having showed itself to be worth this most recent mustering of self-belief in its ability to get through the last 10 days. But what if this was another trick? What if, with Kate leaving, the pain would slide in and take her spot and shame me for ever having thought I could get any further than it had allowed? I could feel my fear of continuing. I would be the one left behind, with people catching up and overtaking me until I gave up, too demoralized to continue and ready to face the ridicule, or worse, the kind, knowing commiseration of those who believed I'd never make it, but didn't want to say so as they waved me off, unsurprised to see me back. No, I couldn't give in to this anymore. I was going to push it, see how far I could get, and take the consequences that came. I studied the dusty road, unclenched my fists, put one hand on my chest, and breathed deeply once. Then turned, smiled, and walked towards the house. "You okay?" Buckshot asked casually, standing apart from the others, but they were already milling closer. I'd already noticed this about him. He was the electric current in a group, the light bulb that people gravitated around. But he didn't always like it, swinging between enjoying holding court and wanting to strike off into his own world. Never totally gone, never quite arrived. Peripheral, that was, until he decided to turn it on full beam. Once I had nodded mutely that I was okay and was going to finish packing some food, he wandered off, getting up to walk on the slack line he'd played around on the day before, agile for a man of his stature on the tightrope-like band. I took a moment to speak to Dozer, 20 years old yet a wise hiker of at least 100 miles, experienced in my eyes. "So, I might come with you guys," I said, hating the need I could hear in my own voice and hoping it wasn't clear to her. "Of course," she said, smiling. "These assholes are just messing with you. It's like that. We want you to come. You're fun. We like you. And we're not doing a damn 30-mile day. They're just being big shots. Ain't you, LB?" She laughed over at Lazy Bean, whose long hair poked out the back of his faded hat, and he turned and shot me a big grin. "Sure as shit, Appalachian Gale. Course you're coming with us. Now get rid of some of that heavy crap in your pack into the hiker box. Let's get going. You don't need that much food. We're stopping in a few days at Karatunk. There's a little resupply there." I smiled towards Lazy Bean and watched him pull his socks over his stick-and-poke, tits-and-bass tattoo that sat on the inside of his foot. I felt overcome with gratitude to them for their inclusion and kindness and that their thousands of miles of trail experience, especially Lazy Bean's and Buckshot's, hadn't made them gatekeepers or made them look down their noses at beginners like me. Even old beginners. Although, at this stage I wondered how old they thought I was, because they were treating me like I wasn't that much older than them. I shoved a huge jar of Nutella and some bars I'd just bought at Shaw's hostel shop straight into the hiker box, cursing myself for wasting money as someone instantaneously came up behind me and leaned over with a, "Hey, check it out! Someone binned a new Nutella in here, dude!" scooping it up over my shoulder even before I let it go. Hiker boxes are an incredible repository of things hikers don't want or need. Most every town or hostel has one, and they range from a tatty shoebox to a range of plastic tubs labelled food, shoes, clothes, and gear. This one was pretty full, and when I later asked why, I understood that Sobo hikers coming out of the 100 Mile realised they'd brought too much for their through and dumped stuff before they carried on. Then, people going into the 100 Mile, Nobos, realised they were on the last stretch, so didn't want to carry anything unnecessary, in order to make way for food instead. No Nobos had really come through yet. It was too early in the season, so the food box was laden with the extra food that overpacked Sobos didn't need. Some people had even packed themselves up a resupply box and sent it to Shaw's before they started the trail, just like they sent their boxes to other post offices to resupply themselves along the way. But they also came out of the 100 Mile with extra food, so it all got dumped in the tubs. I realised the gang was assembling, so I hot-footed it to them, grinning and excited. I was somehow expecting some kind of fanfare for us going, as we'd made lots of new friends in the 24 hours I'd been at Shaw's, but it's clearly the way of it. People slide in and they slip out again, and the people you meet don't expect goodbyes. "See you down trail," is the most you'll hear, whether it's this trail or the next. Nothing forced, no requests for a plan. Poet got into the driver's seat and we got shuttled back to the spot we were picked up at, only the morning before for me. I was so damn tired. I could feel it in my shaking legs, but I couldn't say anything now. If I'd had stopped another day, then I could have had my first zero and rested, but I'd be left behind, and I could already feel that the vibe of this little crew was perfectly aligned with my own and could teach me a lot. So I pushed through on wobbly legs, and a hungover head. Chapter 7. How low can you go? Starting the trail in Maine was the opposite of how I like to eat a good plate of food. We were starting with the best